The coward. The reproach burned in his very soul. But the truth was that he had almost died in that last charge, and now he knew what it felt like to be dying. The fear choked him as palpably as if he'd swallowed a clot of sheep's wool. What was worst of all was knowing that here was one thing he could never share with Ethan. All night, all the next morning, the fear festered so badly that by the time the army reached the bridge, Madden was hysterically happy that the battle was at hand and soon to be over. He was singing under his breath and whistling in turn when the army crested a low rise and saw, just as they'd expected, Lord Pagwell and his allies drawn up by the riverbank to meet them. There was a surprise, however, in the men who waited for them. A bare 100 mounted swordsmen, eked out by 2 big squares of common-born spearmen, placed so that they blocked any possible approach to the bridge itself. "Oh, here," said Madden, forcing a laugh. "Pagwell was a fool to rebel if that's all the riders he could scrape together." "Oh, shit," Caradoc snapped. "His lordship knows what he's doing. I've seen fighting like this before. Spearmen guarding a fixed position. We're in for a little gallop through the third hell, lad." As Maonic's army milled around in confusion, Caradoc led his men calmly up to the front of the line. The enemy had picked a perfect place to stand. A long green meadow in front of the bridge, bordered by the river on one side of their formation, and on the other, the broken crumbling earthwork of some long-gone farmer's cattle corral. 3 rows deep, the spearmen stood shield to shield, the spearheads glittering around the chalk-whitened oval shields. To one side of the shield wall, the mounted men sat on restless horses, ready to charge in from the side and pin Maenowick's men between them and the river. "Horse shit and a pile of it," Caradoc muttered. "We can't wheel around the bastards without falling into the blasted river." Madden merely nodded, too choked for breath to answer. He was remembering the feel of metal biting deep into his side. Under him, his horse tossed its head and stamped, as if it too were remembering their last charge. When Caradoc trotted off to confer with Maenowick, Ethan pulled up beside Madden. He'd already settled his shield over his left arm and drawn a javelin. While he followed the example, Madden had to work so hard to keep his horse steady that he suddenly realized that the poor beast did remember that last charge. He had a battle-shy horse under him, and no time to change him. The spearmen began calling out jeers and taunting the enemy for scum on horseback, screaming into the sunlight and the wind that blew the taunts into jagged, incomprehensible pieces of words. Some of Maenowick's men shouted back, but Caradoc's troop merely sat on their horses and waited until at last their captain left the lord's side and jogged back, easy in his saddle, a javelin in his hand. "All right, lads, we're riding." There was a gust of laughter in the troop as they jogged forward to join him. Maenowick's own men pulled in behind, but the rest of the army wheeled off, ready to charge the enemy riders positioned off to the side. With an odd jingling shuffle, like a load of metal wares jouncing in a cart, the army formed up. Caradoc turned in his saddle, saw Madden right next to him, and yelled at him over the noise.
"Get back! I want to hear our bard sing tonight! Get back in the last rank!"
Madden had never wanted to follow an order more in his life, but he fought with himself only a moment before he shouted back his answer.
"I can't! If I don't ride this charge, then I'll never have the guts to ride another."
Caradoc cocked his head to one side and considered him.
"Well and good then, lad. We might all be doing our listening and singing in the other lands anyway."
Caradoc turned his horse, raised his javelin, then broke into a gallop straight for the enemy lines. With a howl of war cries, the troop burst after him, a ragged race of shrieking men across the meadow. Madden saw the waiting infantry shudder in a wave ripple of fear, but they held.
"Follow my lead!" Ethan screamed. "Throw that javelin and wheel!"
Closer, a cloud of dust kicked up bits and clods of grass, the infantry shoving together behind the line of lime-white shields. Then there was the shower of metal as Caradoc and his men hurled javelins into the spearmen. Shields flashed up, caught some of the darts, but there was cursing and screaming as the riders kept coming, throwing, wheeling, peeling off in a long loose circle. Madden heard battle yells break out behind as the reserve troops charged into Pagwell's cavalry. Snorting, sweating, Mathin's horse fought for the bit and nearly carried them both into the river. Mathin drew his sword, sat the horse with the flat, and jerked its head around to spur it back to the troop. The first rank of Meinowick's men were milling blindly, waving swords and shouting in front of the shield wall. Caradoc galloped among his troop, yelling out orders to reform and try a charge from the flank. Mathin could see that Meinowick's allies had pushed Pagwell's cavalry back to expose the shield wall's weakest spot. In a cloud and flurry of rearing horses, the troop pulled around and threw itself forward again. Mathin lost track of Aethon, who was shoved off to the flank when Meinowick's men, blindly pulling back to charge again, got themselves mixed up with the charging mercenaries. One or two horses went down, their riders thrown and trampled, before Caradoc sorted out the mess into some rough order. Mathin found himself in Meinowick's warband. For one brief moment he could see Caradoc plunging at the flank of the shield wall with a mob behind him. Then his own unit rode forward for the charge. On and on. The shield wall was trembling, turning toward its beleaguered flank, but it held tight directly ahead of Mathin. From the men behind him, javelins flew. Mathin's horse bucked and grabbed for the bit. He smacked it down and kicked it forward. A split-second battle, of nerve, not steel, Mathin saw the slack-jawed face of a young lad, his hands shaking on his braced spear, his eyes suddenly meeting Mathin's as he galloped straight for him. With a shriek, the lad dropped his spear and flung himself sideways. As the man next to him fell, cursing and flailing, Mathin was in. Dimly he saw another horseman to his right. The shield wall was breaking. Swinging, howling with an unearthly laughter, Mathin shoved his horse among the panicked spearmen. Ducking and bobbing in the saddle like a water bird, he slashed out and down, hardly seeing or caring whom or what he was hitting. A spearhead flashed his way. He caught it barely in time and heard his shield crack, then shoved it away as he twisted in the saddle to meet another flash of metal from the right. Always he laughed, the cold bubble of a berserker's hysteria that he could never control in battle. His horse suddenly reared, screaming in agony. As they came down, the horse staggered, its knees buckling, but it couldn't fall. All around was a press panicked infantry, trapped cavalry, horses neighing and men shouting as they shoved blindly at one another. Desperately, Mathin swung out, cutting a spearman across the face as his dying horse staggered a few steps forward. All at once, the line broke, a mob-panicked scuffle of men, throwing spears down, screaming, pushing their fellows aside as they tried to get away from the slashing horsemen. Mathin's mount went down. He had barely time to free his feet from the stirrups before they hit the ground hard, a tangle of man and horse. Mathin's shield fell over his face. He could neither see nor breathe, only scrambled desperately to get up before a retreating spearman stuck him like a pig. On his knees at last, he flung up his shield barely in time to parry a random thrust. The force of the blow cracked the shield through and sent him reeling backwards to his heels. He saw the spearman laugh as he raised the spear again, both hands tight on the shaft to drive it home for the kill. Then a javelin flew into the press and caught the man full in the back. With a scream, he pitched forward, and the men around him ran. Staggering, choking on dust in his own eerie laughter, Mathin got to his feet. Around him the field was clearing as the horsemen charged the fleeing infantry and rode them down, slashing in blind rage at men who could no longer defend themselves. Mathin heard someone yell his name and turned to see Aethon riding for him at a jog.
"Did you throw that dart?" Mathin called out. "Who else? I've heard you laugh before, and I knew that cat squalling meant you were in trouble. Get up behind me. We've won this scrap."
All at once, Mathin's battle fever deserted him. He felt pain, bad pain, cracked ribs burning like fire. Gasping for breath, he grabbed at Aethon's stirrup to steady himself, but the movement made the pain stab him into crying out. With a foul oath, Aethon dismounted and caught him round the shoulders, a well-meant gesture that made Mathin yelp again.
"Hard fall," Mathin gasped.
With Aethon shoving him from behind, Mathin managed to scrabble his way onto the horse. He kept telling himself that riding was better than walking, but he hung onto the saddle peak with both hands to brace himself against the motion as Aethon led the horse out of the death-strewn welter of the battlefield. As they went by, he saw some of Caradoc's men looting the dead, friend and enemy alike. Up the riverbank, the Chirurgeons and their apprentices were waiting for the wounded. Aethon took Mathen over to Cordia, then went back to the field to pull more wounded men out of the dead and dying. When he tried to walk to the Chirurgeon's wagon, Mathen fell, then lay on the ground for an hour, while Cordia frantically worked on the men who were far worse off. At times, Mathen drowsed, only to wake with an oath for his burning ribs. The sun was hot, and he sweated copiously inside the mail he couldn't remove by himself. All he could think about was water, but no one had time to bring him any until Aethon returned. He fetched him a drink, unlaced the mail, and helped him slide it off, then sat down beside him.
"We've won good and proper, for all the good it does us. Mainowick's got Pagwell's body at his feet, and his allies are all suing for peace right now."
"Is Caradoc alive?"
"He is, but not a lot of the godforsaken rest of us are. Matho, we're down to 12 men."
"Ah, can I have some more water?"
Aethon held the water skin so he could drink again. Only then did he truly understand his friend's words.
"Oh, ye gods! Only 12!"
"Just that."
After another hour, Cordia came, his shirt blood-soaked down the front and up to his elbows. All he could do for Mathen's ribs was to bind them with a wet linen band. As it dried in the sun, it would tighten enough to let him sit up. Mathen's left shoulder was also a mass of bleeding, ring-shaped bruises, the mark of his own mail, pressed right down through his clothes when he'd fallen. Cordia washed them down with a slop of mead from a wooden cup. Mathen shrieked once, but then bit his lower lip to keep from doing it again. Cordia handed him the cup.
"Drink the rest of this," Cordia said. "I've put some pain-killing herbs in it too. It'll take the edge off."
The stuff was bitter and stinking, but Mathen got it down a few sips at a time. He was just finishing the cupful when Caradoc came over and half sat, half fell next to him. Caradoc's sweaty face was spattered with some other man's blood, and his eyes were dark and exhausted. With a long sigh, he ran grimy hands through his hair.
"This is the worst scrap I've ever fought."
The captain's voice was halfway between a growl and a whisper.
"Well, what else did I expect? That's what we're for, this dishonored pack of dogs, thrown out ahead of everyone. It's going to happen again, lads. Again and again."
Since the herbed mead was making Mathen's head swim, he had to bend all his will to understand what Caradoc was saying. Aethon put one arm around him and helped him sit up.
"It's a fine short life we're going to have," the captain went on. "Ah, horse shit and a pile of it. Now listen, Matho, I know you rode into that scrap with no guts for it, and I honour you. That's enough. You've proved you're not a coward, so stay out of it from now on. A bard's too valuable a man to lose."
"Can't. What kind of honour would I have?"
"Honour?"
Caradoc tossed his head back and howled with high-pitched laughter.
"Honour? Listen to you. You don't have any honour, you god-cursed little bastard. None of us do. Haven't you listened to one piss-poor word I've been saying? No noble lord sends men with honour into a suicide charge, but they sent us, and I took it because I had to. We've got as much honour as a pack of whores. All that counts is how good we fuck. So stay out of it from now on."
He laughed again, but the pitch was closer to his deep-voiced normal tone.
"Listen, when my weird takes me, I want to know that there's a man still alive who can take over whatever's left of the troop. You pack of whoreson bastards are the only thing I have in life, and blasted if I know why, but I want to know the rotten-ass troop will last longer than I do. From now on, bard, you're my heir."
Caradoc got up and strode away. Mathen slumped back and felt the world spin around him.
"Do what he says," Aethon growled.
Mathen tried to answer, but fainted instead. By the time the army returned to Mainowick's Dun, another man in Caradoc's troop had died. That left 11, plus Caradoc himself, Otho and Cordia, to huddle dispiritedly in the corner of a barracks that had once housed nearly 40 of them. The war over, Lord Mainowick turned generous, telling Caradoc that he was welcome to his shelter until his remaining wounded, Mathen and Stevic, were ready to ride. He also promptly paid over the negotiated wages and even added a couple of silver pieces as a bonus.
Bastard, Caradoc remarked. If he hadn't hired me to do it for him, he would have had to lead that charge himself, and his piss-proud noble lordship knows it.
He'd be dead too, Mathin said. He's not half the man on the field that you are.
Don't flatter the captain, you whelp of a bard, but as a cold, hard assessment like, you're right enough.
After a day or two in bed, Mathin was well enough to go down to the Great Hall for dinner. Caradoc and his men sat together as far away from the rest of the warband as they could, drank hard and said next to nothing, not even to each other. Occasionally, Caradoc would try to joke with his demoralized pack, but it was a hard thing to smile in answer to him. When Mathin grew too tired to sit up, the captain helped him back to the barracks. Otho was already there, twining the rings of a bit of shattered mail by lantern light.
"I've been thinking, Smith," Caradoc said. "Remember our jest about the silver daggers? We've got a good bit of extra coin. Is it enough to make us some?"
"Mayhap. But how am I going to work metal on the road?"
"We'll be sheltering here for at least 1 week, and if Mathin and Stevik groan and moan like dying men, we can eke out another. There's a forge here in the Dun, and the blacksmith says it's a good one."
Otho considered, running gnarled fingers through his beard.
"You need summat to pick the lads up a bit," the dwarf said at last. "I do, and my own spirits could use a little raising for that matter. A silver dagger. It's a nice bit of jewellery for a man to wear."
Caradoc paused to stare into the hearth fire for a long moment.
"I'm beginning to get an idea. Do you know how this troop is going to survive?" "By being the rottenest pack of black-hearted bastards Eldith has ever seen. By making it an honour to become a silver dagger, an honour to a certain kind of man, I mean. Someone like our Aethon. He's as death-besotted and hard a man as I've ever seen. I wouldn't cross him myself. Never wanted to die with a slit throat in a brawl."
Mathin was shocked to the heart. Caradoc was right about Aethon, he realized. His old friend would never again be the man who used to laugh and jest and solve all the little problems of the Cantre warband. It hurt worse than his cracked ribs, thinking about it.
"When you break a man down to naught, he turns into an animal," the captain went on, somewhat meditatively. "Then if you give him summat to live for, he turns into a man again. But it's a hard kind of man, like the blade of a sword. That's the kind of lads I want, and the silver dagger's what they're going to live for."
All at once he grinned, his hiraeth lifting.
"Oh, they'll beg us for it one fine day, but by every sticky hair on the Lord of Hell's ass, they're going to have to earn it. What kind of metal do you need, Otho? I'll ride into town on the morrow and see if I can buy it for you."
"You won't. You'll give me the coin and let me see if I can find what I need. No man learns the formula for this alloy. I cursed well mean it."
"Have it your way, then. But I want a dagger for every man we've got left, and say, 5 more for new recruits, if I can find men worthy of the things, that is."
"Then I'll get started on it right away."
All at once, Otho grinned, the first smile Mathin had ever seen on his face.
"Ah, it's going to feel so good, doing a bit of smelting and mixing again."
Otho was as good as his word. On the morrow he first bribed Lord Mainowick's blacksmith into letting him use the Dunforge, then rode off into town with his wagon. He returned late in the day with sundry mysterious and heavy bundles, which he refused to let any man touch, not even to help him unload. That very night he shut himself up in the forge and stayed there for a solid week, sleeping beside his work, if indeed he slept at all. Once, in the middle of the night, when Mathin went down to the ward to use the privy, he heard hammering coming from the forge and saw red light glowing through the window. On the morning when the daggers were finished, Caradoc decided that it was time to leave Mainowick's hospitality. Not only were Mathin and Stevik both healed, but he wanted Otho to display his handiwork someplace where he could avoid awkward questions about it. After a last farewell to the Lord, the troop saddled up and rode out, but they went only a half mile down the road before they turned off it, jogging out into a wild meadow and forming a rough circle about the smith and his wagon.
"Get him out, Otho," Caradoc said. "Dismount, men, so you can see clearly."
The troop clustered round while a proud, if somewhat weary, Otho unpacked a large leather sack. Nestled in straw were daggers for each of them, beautiful weapons, with a blade that glowed like silver, but was harder than the finest steel. Madin had never handled weapon or tool with such a sharp edge.
"You won't have to polish these much, neither,"
Otho said.
"They won't tarnish, not even in blood. Now, if any of you wants a mark or device-like graved onto it, I'll do it. But you're paying me a silver piece for the job."
"This'll do to cut a throat with, won't it?"
Athen said to Madin.
"Blasted right. I've never had a knife I liked more."
As solemnly, as carefully as priests performing a rite, the troopers drew their old daggers and replaced them with the new. Although Caradoc seemed to be hardly watching, his eyes lazy and heavy-lidded, Madin knew that he was judging the effect of the gesture. The men were smiling, slapping each other on the back, standing straight for a change, their morale better than it had been in days.
"Well and good, then," Caradoc said. "We're all silver daggers now, lads. Doesn't mean a lot, I guess, except that we fight like sons of bitches and we earn our hire."
Spontaneously, the troop cheered him, ragged remnant though it was. When they remounted, they all formed of their own accord into a tight military order and trotted down the road to Caminwain, where Caradoc had promised them a day of liberty before they started searching for a new hire. Near the west gate, they found an inn that seemed big enough to shelter the lot of them, but the skinny, trembling innkeep announced that it was full.
"The stable looks empty to me," Caradoc said. "We'll pay you the going price."
"And what if you wreck the place? The wretched coin won't do me one bit of good then."
"And what if we wreck it without paying you first?"
Although he moaned and wrung his hands, the innkeep gave in quickly. In truth, he did have some custom, enough so that Athen and Madin ended up sharing a small chamber tucked under the roof. While they ate their noon meal in the tavern room, the entire troop talked about women. Caradoc dispensed what was left of their wages along with some orders.
"We're in a town we may visit again some day, so you keep your paws off any lasses who don't want you, and your fists out of the faces of decent citizens, and I don't want to hear about anyone puking their guts out in a townsman's garden either. Do it in the gutters and leave their daughters alone."
After one hurried goblet of mead, Madin and Athen went out for a stroll. By then it was mid-afternoon, and the streets were full of townsfolk hurrying about their business. They all took one quick look at the pair of mercenaries, then either crossed the street or turned down an alleyway to avoid them. After a leisurely circuit of the town, they found a little tavern next to the baker's and went in. They had the place pretty much to themselves, except for the serving lass, a tousled sort of blonde with a soft round face and heavy breasts. When she brought them tankards of dark ale, she lingered with an impartial smile for them both.
"Not bad," Madin thought, and he could tell from Athen's predatory eyes that he agreed.
"What's your name?" Athen asked.
"Drefa. And what's yours?"
"Athen, and this is Madin. You don't happen to have a friend as pretty as you, do you? We could all sit down and have a bit of a chat."
"Chat indeed. And I suppose you lads are interested in a nice game of Carnowick or Gwitherbickle."
"Do you have a better sort of game in mind?"
"I might. It depends on how generous you are."
Athen raised a questioning eyebrow in Madin's direction.
"What about that friend?" Madin said.
"Well now, most of them will be busy this time of day. It's a pity you didn't come by at night, like."
"Ah, by the hells, then why bother?" Athen said with a shrug. "Why don't you just come back to our inn with us? We've got a proper bed, better than a hayloft, and we'll buy you a skin of mead."
Caught between drunkenness and fastidiousness, Madin shot him a foul look, but Athen was paying strict attention to the lass. Drufa giggled in a pleasurable surprise.
"It might be rather amusing," she announced. "I'll go get the mead and just tell Dar where I'm going."
When she minced off, Athen turned to Madin with a shrug.
"Wet fur, dry fur, does it matter?"
His voice cracked.
"They're all bitches anyway."
Madin finished the ale in his tankard in two long gulps. He had the vague thought of slipping away on the street, letting Athen have this lass and finding himself another, but he was too drink-muddled to find his way back on his own in this unfamiliar town.
When they came round to the back door of the inn, Ethan paused long enough to lean Druffer against the wall and kiss her. Madhin found the sight exciting in a troubling sort of way. He made no protest when the lass suggested they all go upstairs. Yet once they were in the quiet chamber, Madhin's shyness returned in force. He barred the door behind them and rummaged in a saddlebag for a wooden cup while Ethan untied the mead skin. Druffer giggled and took it away from him.
"Let's leave the drinking for later. You promised me a bit of fun, Ethan."
"So I did. Take off that dress, then."
With a peal of giggles, Druffer began to untie her highly inappropriate virgin's kirtle. The cup clutched in his hand, Madhin watched as she undressed, slowly, smiling at the pair of them the entire time. When she stepped out of the underdress to reveal soft pale skin and dark nipples, he felt the sexual tension in the room like a stroke across his groin. She gave Ethan one kiss, then turned to Madhin, took the cup out of his hand, and kissed him too, drawing them both after her to sit down on the bed. It was several hours after sundown before they let her make her escape, pleading exhaustion between giggles. In a drunken, satisfied gallantry, Madhin put on enough of his clothes to escort her downstairs and press a clutch of coppers into her hand. Although he may have been overpaying her, he felt she'd earned it. When he staggered back into the chamber, he found the candle burning itself out in the lantern, and Ethan sound asleep and snoring on his side of the bed. Madhin took off his brigger, threw a blanket over Ethan, then blew out the candle and lay down. The room spun slowly and majestically around him in a gold-flecked darkness. "And what would old Nevin think of me now?" he thought. "Well, thanks be to the gods, he'll never know what became of me." Then he fell asleep as suddenly as he'd blown out the candle. When he left Dundevery, Nevin headed straight south, following the open road that ran beside the Bellaver. He'd gone no more than 5 miles when he met a mounted patrol of 5 of the king's riders coming right for him. Automatically, thinking little of it, he pulled off to the side to let them pass, but their leader hailed him and trotted over, blocking his path.
"That's a fine mule you've got there, Herdman. He's going to see the king's service, too."
"Oh, is he now?"
Nevin looked deep into the man's eyes and sent a soothing flow of magnetic force out of his aura.
"You don't want this mule. He comes up lame too often to be of use to you."
"Do you think I'd fall for such a clumsy ruse?"
He started to laugh, then merely shook his head, his eyelids drooping.
"Clumsy ruse. I don't want that mule. Truly, you don't want this mule."
The warrior yawned, shook himself, then turned his horse around.
"Come on, lads, we don't want that mule. He comes up lame too often to be any use to us."
Although they looked puzzled, the others obeyed him without question and trotted after as he headed back toward Dundevery. In a bad temper, Nevin rode on, and this time he kept a good watch out for mounted men. The incident made him think over his proposed route. Although he'd been planning on riding to Eldith, he disliked the idea of having to ensorcel endless patrols of confiscating warriors the whole way there. Thanks to the war, he could no longer simply take a ship from Caermore, but just possibly there were less legitimate ships that ran the border far out to sea, where few could catch them. Even though it was a good bit out of his direct route, he decided to swing by Dunmananan and see what he could find. At that time, Dunmananan was a pleasant-looking town of some 2,000 souls, whose round houses marched up from the harbour in tidy semicircles. Despite the war, every house looked oddly prosperous, with fresh thatch, nicely whitewashed walls, and a handsome cow and a flock of hens in every yard. The town's one inn was clean and tidy too, with a proper stable out back. It was quite a surprise then when he went into the tavern room and found the innkeep cooking stew at a hearth where the spit across the fire, the kettle itself, and the long spoon were made of bronze, not iron. When he commented about it, the innkeep snarled under his breath.
"You won't find a bit of good iron all along the Caermore coast, good sir. Nought can come south through the country battle lines, you see, and our wonderful king and his wonderful warbands have to have shoes for their misbegotten horses and swords and such like. So they strip every bit of iron they can find, right down to the rotten buckle on your belt, and if you ask for repayment, you get it in bruises."
He paused to spit into the fire.
Even the ploughshares are tipped with bronze, and they don't plough as deep, I tell you. So there's less of a yield every year, and the misbegotten king still takes the same taxes out of it.
I see. Ye gods, I never dreamt things had gone as far as all this. I only wonder how far they'll go. Soon enough we'll all have gold hinges on our privy doors. It'll be cheaper than iron.
His laugh was not a pleasant one. As the evening wore on, a fair amount of customers drifted into the inn. As soon as they realized that Nevin was a herbman, he had custom of his own, and set up something of a dispensary on a table in the curve of the wall, out of the tavernman's way. When he was done, a young sailor named Sakir, who'd brought herbs to ease a bad hangover, settled down next to him and insisted on buying a round of ale so that he could start developing his symptoms all over again.
"Will you be staying in Dunmanannan long, sir?"
"I won't, truly. I'm hoping to find a ship going to Morlin, on the Eldith border, you know, one that has the draft to take my horse and mule. There are some valuable herbs that only grow in that part of the kingdom."
Sakir nodded, taking the lie with the faith of the ignorant, and considered the question.
"Well, I do know a man who's running a good-sized boat west. He might be stopping in Morlin."
"Stopping there? How much further west can you go these days?"
Looking suddenly stricken, Sakir devoted himself to his tankard.
"Now here," Nevin dropped his voice to a whisper, "I truly like to get to Eldith, and I'll pay well for my passage. Is that at all possible?"
"It just might be. Wait around here a bit."
In about an hour, a stout greying man in the checked brigger of a merchant appeared, pausing in the tavern door and looking around carefully before he came any further. When Sakir hailed him, he strolled over to the table, but he had a cautious eye for Nevin.
"Sit down, Cabith," Sakir said. "There's coin in it."
With a small smile, the merchant sat. Sakir leaned across the table to whisper, "This herdman has a great desire to get to Eldith. He needs a ship that can carry stock. I don't suppose you'd know of such a thing."
"Well,"
Cabith paused to size Nevin up,
"it's a dangerous trip, good sir. I can't guarantee your safety if the Eldith war galleys catch us." "Ah, I see."
Nevin was quite sure that he could do the guaranteeing, though he didn't dare tell Cabith that, of course.
"But slipping across the border by land won't be much safer, and it'd be a cursed sight longer." "True enough. But what if you came across from the west, right by Canabane?" "Perfect. That's exactly where I want to go." "Well and good, then. How many head of stock do you have?" "Only one horse and a mule." "Oh, well now, that's no trouble at all. You see, I've got a cattle boat that'll hold 100 head easy, but we'll be running empty on the westward trip." "I think I begin to understand. You found a less than patriotic Eldith man who's selling you war horses for the Caermore army."
"Not an Eldith man," Cabith leaned close to whisper. "Some of the west folk. Ever heard of them? They're a strange lot. They crop their babies' ears like calves, and they speak this language that'd break your jaw. But they raise beautiful horses. But best of all, they hate the men of Eldith with a passion, so they sell at good prices to supply Eldith's enemies."
Nevin caught his breath. Although he knew that the elves never forgot a grudge, he was surprised at how far they would go to satisfy one. On the next night, Nevin went down to the dark, silent harbour about the middle of the third watch, when the tide was turning to run out. At the end of a long wooden pier, muffled lanterns winked with a narrow beam beside the squat shape of the cattle boat. Nevin coaxed his animals across the gangplank and settled them in solitary splendour in the hold, then came back up on deck. Cabith showed him the low cabin, built on deck like a hut, that they would share. Two narrow bunks bolted to the wall, and a tiny table and bench bolted to the floor.
"The lads sleep on deck, but we do put up an old tent if it rains," Cabith remarked. "The ship has to look shabby, you see, and I have to look poor."
He shuddered briefly.
"Let's pray to Mananan Aplir to keep the Eldith galleys away. Once we pass Caermore, we'll pick up an escort, you'll see. But I've no desire to find myself in the middle of a sea battle."
Even though the wind was brisk, it took them 2 full days to reach Caermore in the lumbering, awkward boat. They never put into the harbour, because a sleek Caermore war galley was already waiting for them. Cabith ordered the sails down and let the boat drift while the galley manoeuvred alongside and grappled on.
The rowers, all free men and marines, rested at their oars while their captain made the precarious jump up to the cattle boat's deck.
"We'll follow the usual plan," he said to Cabith. "You stay about 15 miles out to sea. We'll follow a parallel course just in sight of you. We'll meet at the usual harbour near the West Folk's camp."
"Done then, but come in our way every now and then so I can see that we haven't lost you."
As long as they were in Deverry waters, the two ships sailed close together, but about noon of the next day, Cabith and his crew turned the cattle boat's clumsy nose out to sea and wallowed along against the tide until the galley's captain hailed them and told them they'd gone far enough out. Although Cabith turned again, the galley kept going, heading out to sea. From that point on, Cabith spent most of his time in the bow, keeping watch himself rather than trusting one of his men. 4 long, anxious days and nights on the open sea brought them finally far enough west to turn back inland. Soon the Caermore galley joined them, and they sailed together to a tiny harbour, little more than a bite out of the chalk cliffs, with a short, rickety pier. Although the cattle boat edged in beside it, the galley headed straight for the sandy beach. As the high-carved prow scraped on land, the marines jumped over the side, grabbed the gunwales in well-trained unison, and ran her up onto the sand.
"Well, Nevin," Cabith said, "will you shelter on board tonight?"
"My thanks, but it's just a bare hour past noon. I'll be on my way."
As soon as Nevin got his horse and mule on deck, they smelled land and practically bolted for it. He led them across the soft sand to the scrubby grassland just beyond the beach, then returned to fetch his saddles and mule packs. A couple of the sailors helped him carry the gear over.
"Look!"
one of the lads pointed.
"West Folk!"
On golden horses, 2 men and a woman were riding up, sitting easy in their elaborately stamped and tasseled leather saddles, their pale hair like moonlight to their mount sun. The sailors dumped Nevin's gear near his stock, then ran back toward their ship as if they thought the elves would eat them or such like. When Nevin called out a friendly greeting in Elvish, the woman turned her horse and trotted over, though the 2 men continued on to meet the marines.
"Greeting, Elder One," she said in the same tongue. "You speak too well to be a merchant."
"No, I'm not. I'm a friend of a Derren of the Silver Wings. Do you know him?"
"I know of him, but never has the honour been mine to meet him. Do you study the Moonland lore too?"
"Yes. I'm going to be travelling east from here, going to Eldith. Will I be safe on the road?"
"A man like you is always safe among the people. But watch out for the Eldith swine. You never know what they'll do."
"Oh, yes,"
Nevin agreed for politeness' sake.
"I'm surprised you'll trade with my people at all."
"The longer the war goes on, the more Eldith men die. Besides, they won't be trying to take our lands as long as there's fighting to the east."
She raised her hand in mock salute.
"May there be a king in Caermore for 100 years.
Although he was planning on going to Eldith eventually, Nevin's real destination lay just to the west of the border, where out to sea rise the 3 drowned peaks that form the islands of Wimglaith. Nevin rode along the sea cliffs through meadows of tall, windswept grass for the rest of that day, and on into the next, when he reached the low hills where neither men nor elves lived. On the 3rd day, he came through a narrow pass to a wide rocky beach, where the slow waves washed over gravel with a sad mutter, as if the sea was endlessly talking to itself. A scant 2 miles offshore, he saw the dark rise of the main island against the silver glitter of the southern sea. Since the tide was at its full, Nevin had to wait before he could cross over. He led his animals down to the 2 stone pillars that marked the entrance to the stone causeway, still underwater at the moment, and watched the waves lapping at the carved notches. Sure enough, the tide was turning, as each wave fell a little lower than the one before. Crying and mewling, seabirds swooped down as if to take a look at him, the graceful gulls, the occasional osprey, and the ungainly pelicans who were sacred to the god Wim. As he idly watched the birds, Nevin thought over the job ahead of him, convincing the priests of the Water Temple to aid the Dwayomer in the work of healing the torn kingdom. He was oppressed by doubts, thinking about his elaborate scheme in cold blood made it seem daft. As the waves fell back, the long causeway emerged, streaming water like a silver sea snake. Nevin waited until the sun and wind had dried it off, then led his bulky stock across. Snorting, they picked their hooves up high on the unfamiliar footing. Ahead, the island rose up, about 10 miles long and 7 wide, with a low hill standing in the midst of meadows of coarse seagrass. Since the day was sunny, a rare thing at Wimglaith, he could just pick out the temple buildings themselves as he went across. At the end of the causeway stood a stone arch, carved with panels of interlace and roundels decorated with pelicans, and an inscription, "Water covers and reveals all things." Just as Nevin left the causeway for solid land, a young priest came hurrying across the meadow to meet him. A blond lad of about 16, he was dressed in dark brigger and a linen overshirt of an ordinary cut, but on the yokes of the shirt, where a lord's blazon would go, were orange pelicans.
"Welcome, good traveller. What brings you to the Water Temple of Wim?"
"I need the help of the oracles of the god. My name is Nevin,
and mine's Kinray. The god gives oracles to all who ask."
The temple complex was a good mile away across the wind-blown meadow. As they walked along, Kinray said not a word more, and Nevin wondered about him and his reasons for choosing this lonely life so young. He was a good-looking boy, though his slender face was chapped and red from the continual sea wind, but his blue eyes were oddly distant, a bit wistful, as if he felt that ordinary life had nothing to offer him. In the shelter of the hill rose a high stone broch, and scattered around it, some storage sheds, 2 small roundhouses, and the stables. A few wind-gnarled trees cast small patches of shade. A few flowers struggled to bloom in the shelter of walls. The wind sighed around the buildings and swirled the sandy dust in a perpetual scour. Out beyond the complex, Nevin could see the kitchen gardens, a field of barley, and some white cows at pasture. Although the pious made donations to Wim when they wanted his advice, the coin would never have been enough to provision the temple. Kinray pointed to a small round hut with a freshly thatched roof right by the stable well.
"That's the guest house, good sir. I'll put your baggage in there after I've stabled your horse and mule. See the big house over there? That belongs to the high priest, and you can pay him your respects straight away."
"My thanks, and I will. Is Adonic still the head of the order here?"
"Oh, he died ever so long ago. Pedraddin was called to replace him."
As so often happened, Nevin was caught by surprise at just how fast the time seemed to go, for other men. He remembered Pedraddin as an earnest acolyte, not much older than Kinray, but the man who greeted him at the door of the High Priest's residence had a thick streak of grey in his dark hair, and the slow, solid walk of a man secure in his years and his position.
"By the feet and feathers of the holy birds, can it truly be Nevin?"
"It is, at that. Do you remember me? Why, it must have been 20 years ago that I was here."
"It was, but you made quite an impression on me. It's a marvel to see you looking so hale. You must be the best testimonial for your herbs that ever a man could have. Or is it the Dwayoma that keeps you so fit?"
"The Dwayoma, truly, in its own way. It gladdens my heart to see you, too."
Pedraddin ushered him into a spare stone room that held one table, one bench, a narrow cot and a vast set of shelves, stacked with codices and scrolls in leather cases. In the pink sandstone fireplace, a peat fire smouldered to take off the sea chill. When the high priest clapped his hands, a servant came in the back door. He was a man in his 30s, dark-haired, and he had the worst scar on his face that Nevin had ever seen. Thick knots and welts of shiny scar tissue that ran through his left cheek and clotted at the corner of a mouth twisted in a perpetual parody of a smile.
"Davin, get our guest and me some spice milk. Then you can do what you'd like until dinner."
With a silent nod, he left by the same door.
"He can't speak clearly," Pedraddin said to Nevin. "He was an elder sailor once. We found him washed up on our beach and bleeding half to death from those wounds. That was about 6 years ago now. He begged to stay here with us, and I can't say I blamed him for wanting out of the wars. A silent man makes a good servant for a priest."
After Davin brought the milk, priest and sorcerer sat down together by the fire. Nevin had a sip of the sweet milk and wished that the priests of Wim weren't forbidden to drink ale and mead.
"With your skill in Dwayoma, I'm surprised you'd come to us for an oracle."
"The oracle I need concerns the entire land of Deveri and Eldith, not merely my own doings, Your Holiness. I also came to ask your aid in a certain peculiar matter. Tell me, does it ache your heart to see the wars raging and no end in sight?"
"Do you truly need to ask?
It would ache the heart of any sane man. Just so. We who serve the Dwayomer of Light have joined together, and we have a plan to end the wars, but we can't do it without the help of those who serve the gods. I've come to beg you to help put the one true king upon his throne.
Pedrathin's eyes widened like a child's.
Who is he? He whispered.
I don't know yet, but you have every important genealogy and noble bloodline stored away in your records. Once Great Wim gives us an omen, surely we can interpret it with the help of the archives.
I see. And once you know his name?
Then the Dwayomer will put him on his throne. Let me tell you my scheme.
Pedrathan listened quietly at first, then flung himself out of his chair and began pacing back and forth in sheer excitement.
It could work, the priest burst out. With the help of the gods and the Dwayomer behind it, we could do it. The cost, though, by my most holy lord, a good many men will die in such a war.
Will it be any more than a dying already? At least this war will put an end to it, or so we can hope. What hope do we have now?
None, sure enough. On the morrow we'll consult the god.
Dinner that night was served in the broch in a vast round room, smoky from the torches in the peat fire that served as refectory and kitchen both. The five priests, their three servants, and whatever guests there were, all ate together at two long tables, with no show of rank. Even the high priest got up to fetch himself more milk and stew if he wanted them. The quiet talk was of books and gardening, the religious exercises of the priests, and the slow life of the island. Nevin envied them. His life would soon revolve around kings and warfare, politics and death, the very things he tried to leave behind when he chose the Dwayomer Road, as he remarked to Pedrathin.
The man who runs from his weird finds it waiting for him, or so the proverb goes, the priest said, but yours seems to be an unusually fast runner.
After a pleasant night in the clean, comfortable guest house, Nevin woke to a world turned grey by fog. It lay so thick on island and sea that land and water seemed the same element. In the windless damp, every word spoken hung in the air like a tuft of sheep's wool caught on a bramble. When Kinray came to fetch him, the lad was wearing an orange cloak with the hood up against the damp.
"I hope the fog doesn't bother you, aged sir."
"It doesn't, lad, but my thanks for your concern. I've got a good heavy cloak of my own."
"Good. I like the fogs. They make a man feel safe somehow."
Kinray led the way through the grey-shrouded complex and out to the gardens where Pedrathin was waiting. Although it was only about 100 yards away, the top of the broch was lost in fog. Without speaking, they walked up the grassy hill to the small round temple at the top. Inside was a single plain room of worked stone, with 8 freestanding pillars set around and 8 small oil lamps on the altar. Pedrathin and Nevin knelt before the altar while Kinray lighted the lamps, an eerie pale glow in the heavy air. It seemed that the fog had followed them inside and hung over the altar and the niche behind, where there was a statue of Wim, or Ogmios as he was known in the dawn time. The god was sitting cross-legged on a stool, with his right hand raised in benediction and his left holding a reed pen. As the light flared up, his calm face seemed to smile at his worshippers. Kinray knelt down beside Nevin and stared at his god in sincere devotion. Pedrathin prayed aloud, asking the god to favour Nevin's request and to grant them both wisdom, and he went on at a good length, his voice echoing through the room. Although the usual worshipper would have been listening to the priest and little more, Nevin had the skills to make a direct link with the force, or the part of the inner lands, if you prefer, that Wim represented. In his mind he built up a thought form of the god behind his statue, carved it from the blue light, worked and perfected it until the image lived apart from his will. Then he used a trick of the mind to force his imaginings out through his eyes until he saw it standing behind the altar. Slowly, the god force that Pedrathin was summoning came to ensoul it. Nevin knew he was successful when Kinray cried out, a sob of joy, and raised his hand to greet what he saw as a visitation of the god. Nevin felt a bit dishonourable, as if he'd tricked the lad, but on the other hand, the image did represent a truth. At the end of the prayer, the three of them sat for a long moment of silence. A bit at a time, Nevin withdrew the force he'd put into the actual image and thanked the god for appearing to them. Kinray's devotion kept it alive a little longer, but soon the unstable etheric substance went its own way, spinning off, swirling and dissolving as the god force left its temporary home. Kinray sobbed once under his breath, like a child who sees his mother go off to work in the fields but knows he can't call her back. Pedrathin rose and closed the temple working with a short chant, then clapped his hands 8 times in slow, stately succession.
"We are blessed," Pedrathin said. "He has appeared to us."
Again, Nevin felt rather shabby. He felt sorry for the priests, particularly young Kinray, who would never know the truth about the object of his devotion, never realize that he could learn to call the god at will. Yet, as he thought about it, perhaps it was better that way. How, after all, can one love an objective natural force that can be summoned in cold blood to ensoul an artificial image? In a way, there's little room for love in the Dwayoma, which is why mankind needs priests like Kinray. Silently, in single file, they left the temple and walked down the far side of the hill. The fog still lay thick, but through the clinging damp came the distant boom and echo of waves striking rock. As they picked their way through a vast meadow of coarse seagrass, the waves grew louder and louder, until at last they reached the cliff at the far side of the island. Down below, across a gravelled beach, great rocks rose jagged out of the swirling white surf. The ocean crashed over them with sheets of spray like birds' wings, then flowed all white and foaming through the narrow channels between.
"Behold the voices of the god!"
Pedrathin cried. The ocean roar answered him with 100 tongues. As they slowly made their way down the damp, treacherous stairs cut into the side of the rocky cliff, the roar and boom of the surf grew so deafening that it seemed to echo inside Nevin's mind as well as in his ears. At the tide line, the three of them knelt on the slimy gravel and raised their hands palm outward to the oracle. Each great wave swept in like an omen, spraying over the rocks and swirling with white foam up almost to their knees.
"Almighty Whim,"
Nevin called out,
"we beg you guide us in choosing the one true king of all Dveri. Almighty Whim, put the true king on the throne and no other. Almighty Whim, lend us your power to tell truth from falsehood."
One after the other, the waves swept in from the grey misty ocean that might have broken on Eldith's shore or on that of the other lands for all they could tell. The voices roared and boomed incomprehensible answers to Nevin's question. All at once, Kinray sobbed and rose slowly to his feet, his eyes staring all unseeing in deep trance. When he spoke, his thin lad's tenor had changed into a voice as deep and hollow as wave on rock.
"Look in the north and west. The lad who will be king has been born in the north and west. The king of all Dveri and all Eldith has been born in a lake among the fishes and the water reeds. He who will give peace trains for war."
With a sharp cry, Kinray fainted, falling forward headlong as the god left him. Nevin and Pedrathin raised him up, then carried him away from the tide line to the tenuous shelter of the foot of the cliff. Pedrathin stripped off his own cloak and wrapped it around the boy.
"Nevin, he's the priest you get only once in 100 years, if that. He'll succeed me and surpass me 1,000 times. I thank the god every day for bringing him here."
"So you should, and for his sake too. I don't know what would have happened to him if he hadn't found the way of the god."
"Oh, his family thought he was a bit simple-minded, sure enough. They brought him here to ask the god's advice when he was but a tiny lad, and he's never left. Sometimes I wonder if there's some Westfolk blood in our Kinray, but of course I couldn't possibly go asking his kin a shameful thing like that."
He laid a fatherly hand on the boy's cheek.
"He's icy cold. I wish we could get him away from the damp."
"Naught easier. Just give him to me."
Nevin called on the spirits of the elements, an almost automatic task there in that rage and vortex of elemental force, and asked them to support the lad's weight. With their help, he picked Kinray up like a sack of grain and carried him up the steps without even having to pause for breath. He brought the lad well away from the edge, then laid him down gently in the cushioning grass, while Pedrathin stared in utter amazement. In a few minutes, Kinray tossed his head this way and that, then opened his eyes.
"I can walk soon, Your Holiness," he whispered.
"When you're ready, lad, and not before,"
Pedrathan knelt down beside him.
And some day soon you'll learn how to control the force of the god.
Nevin walked a few steps away and turned to look over the distant swirl of fog and ocean. The voices of the god echoed softly in the distance.
North and west, he thought. I would have been wasting my time if I'd gone to Caremore.
He had no doubt that the omen was a true one. Reinforced by the ritual and the dramatic physical setup of the oracle, Kinray's raw psychic talent had tapped in deep to the Daveri racial soul. Born in the midst of reeds and fishes, that particular phrase bothered him, but he was sure that in time everything would become clear. All in all, he was well pleased. Only later did he remember that ominous phrase, King of all Daveri and all of Eldith, and wonder just what mighty forces he had set in motion. That afternoon, while Kinray slept, Nevin and Pedrathan went to the Chamber of Records, which occupied the entire second floor of the Brock. Aided by another neophyte, they sat at a table by a window and pored over dusty codex after dusty codex of genealogies. As they compiled lists of heirs, both direct on the male line and indirect through the sons of royal women, one name reappeared three times. Marin, marked prince of the small kingdom of Pierden, related vaguely to the elder's throne, tightly to the Cantrey claimant through his mother, and most directly indeed to the Caremore line through Prince Cobrin, Danyan's son. Realizing that a man of Danyan's line might someday hold the throne of all Daveri made Nevin shudder with the Dwayoma cold. It was just the sort of irony that the lords of Weird seemed to love.
"This lad interests me."
Nevin tapped the name with a bone stylus.
"Do you know anything about him?"
"I don't. Pierden's a long way away. At times I even have trouble getting correct information for my records."
"You don't think the lad might be dead or such like?"
"I doubt that. Usually someone will make an effort to tell me of a thing as important as the death of a marked prince. I only meant that I'd never laid eyes on the lad or his mother. I saw his father once when Castle was, 12, I'd say. He impressed me as a nice child, but still, who knows what's happened since then?"
Since, if their plan was to succeed, they would need the help of at least one powerful priest of Bell, Nevin headed directly back to Daveri, rather than going hundreds of miles out of his way to Pierden. He gave the job of looking over young Prince Marin to a Derin, who was roaming with his Alar near the border of the kingdom. Nevin had just crossed into Daveri proper when a Derin contacted him through his campfire.
"I think we found our claimant."
Adarin's image was smiling, but in a thoughtful sort of way.
"Pierden's a harsh place, but it's the right sort of harshness, the kind that keeps a man mindful that he needs other people to survive. I was most impressed with King Castle. He has an honour that's rare even in the best of times. The young prince seems bright beyond his years, but he's only 5, so it's a bit early to tell how he's going to turn out. He seems healthy, though. It would be a pity if he died in childhood."
"True spoken. But then Castle might have another son or two yet. I hate storing all my mead in one skin."
"So do I, but we've got to. The whole problem is that we've got 2 beastly many would-be kings."
"Just so. What about the omens?"
"They couldn't be more right. Dundrillock is Castle's primary residence, and that's where the young prince was born. It's a fortified island, right out in the middle of a lake."
"Excellent. My thanks for your help. I'm on my way to Luke Khan. I remember the High Priest of Bell there as being a decent, honourable man. Well, if he hasn't up and died on me anyway."
Since it was far enough from the Caremore border to be spared the worst ravages of war, Luke Khan was still prosperous and the biggest city left in Daveri. The centre of the iron workings, it was continually dusted with fine dark ash from its smelters, forges, and of course the big beehive ovens where wood was turned into charcoal. In the still summer air, the haze hung over the city and turned the sky yellow. Nevin made his way to the centre of town where the Temple of Bell stood among soot-dusted ancient oaks. He was well known there, and neophytes came running to take his horse and mule as soon as he entered the sacred grove. Much to his relief, Olaith, the High Priest, was very much alive, though severely troubled by pains in his joints. A neophyte ushered Nevin into Olive's chamber, which was bare except for a narrow hard pallet on the floor and one chair.
"You'll forgive me if I don't rise, Nevin. The pain in my back is bad today." "You've got to get yourself a proper bed. It doesn't have to be soft or some such sinful thing. You've just got to get out of the draught." "I'll consider it, then."
The neophyte brought Nevin a low stool, then took himself away. Nevin launched straight into his plans. The priesthood of Bell was in the perfect position to interpret oracles and omens in the